dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man whose intelligence, I believe, is worth tapping with regularity, and he's kind enough to allow us to do so by coming on the program periodically to update us on the work that he is doing, among other places, at the Federalist and the Claremont Institute, where he is a fellow. And the other thing that I believe has commended him to us is his new book, American Ingrate, about Ilhan Omar. He is, of course, Benjamin Weingarten, and I am thrilled to have him with us today to talk about something that he's on that I think hasn't gotten nearly enough attention, and that is woke capitalism, as it's being called, particularly that practiced by Larry Fink of BlackRock, and some pushback that thoughtful conservatives like him are now mounting. I'm very pleased to have him with us. Ben, good to have you. Thanks for taking a few minutes. I wanted to specifically, again, thank you for writing up at the Federalist some of the latest musings and engagements that are taking place over this idea that American businesses need to conform to the agenda of the radical left now under the coercive power of Larry Fink and BlackRock. Tell us what's going on that front.
I think at a 30,000 foot level, the key thing to understand is that corporate America and really global multinational corporations writ large, many of them have said basically to hell with the concept of our mandate to maximize shareholder value. Businesses should be responsible for all manner of stakeholders, so-called. And what that translates into is businesses promoting a progressive, leftist, globalist agenda. And in the form of BlackRock, which the CEO of which is Larry Fink, BlackRock being the largest asset manager in the world with over $7 trillion under management, and which has also been on several occasions hired by the federal government or quasi-independent agencies associated with the federal government, in particular has been a leader in this sort of woke capital movement in seeking to try to impose upon those in whom its clients invest and those with whom it transacts sort of leftist business principles, even to the point of, for example, not allowing investors to invest in businesses in the coal production industry, essentially trying to use its weight as a massive player in the marketplace to impose the leftist agenda and punish those companies who don't hew to it. And when a massive company like a BlackRock contracts with the government, yet also has this progressive agenda associated with it, you can see all manner of disastrous consequences as a result of that. And this Back to Neutral campaign is so critical because finally, there's pushback among conservatives against a business world that, in my view, either really consists of true believers at the most senior levels, or I think in many cases has been cowed into submission and forced to take on this so-called social justice progressive agenda as a consequence of leftist agitation. And the last point I'll quickly make is that the hypocrisy in this is amazing because while the likes of BlackRock and many others on Wall Street are now hewing to the social justice sort of line, at the very same time, they're increasing their exposure to the Chinese marketplace at a dramatic rate. And of course, that means a marketplace that serves ultimately the Chinese Communist Party, which has principles that are completely antithetical to the social justice agenda that they are trying to impose upon us. So the hypocrisy couldn't be more bright.
I'm a big supporter of, in fact, participating in this Back to Neutral campaign, and very pleased that you're calling attention to it, Ben, as it does seem to me, it's long overdue and much needed. And that's especially so at a moment when so many Americans, rightly, I think, are furious about what the communist Chinese have done to us. And so this hypocrisy, this disconnect between, on the one hand, promoting this sort of radical environment, social justice, governance agenda on the one hand, and on the other, simultaneously, Larry Fink, BlackRock, others like him at Wall Street, are turning a blind eye, as you say, to the complete indifference, really, of the Chinese Communist Party to, you know, environmental stewardship and true social justice, not just totalitarian communism's pretense at it, and transparency with respect to governance and the like. These are things that I think will, as more and more Americans learn of them, horrify them and hopefully engender opposition to what's being done. But talk about, you know, what, as a practical matter, we can do besides letter writing to try to counter the extortion, I think that's not too strong a term, that Larry Fink and BlackRock are now engaged in with corporate boardrooms across America.
Yeah, well, when it comes in particular to the use of financial markets to essentially impose these values, these progressive so-called values, on people, which really means, let's break it down to its most simple level. If you are invested via a retirement account in a mutual fund that is in the financial services industry today, managed by any one of these companies, chances are there's an ever-increasing part of your hard-earned savings that are going towards the Chinese Communist Party, in effect. So what do we do about that? As Roger Robinson has argued, and I know you've had him on your program many times before, and he's been exceptional on this point, simple matters of forcing Chinese companies that get access to our capital markets to provide the same level of disclosure, transparency, and accountability that all Western companies have to adhere to, that alone would be it would cause a remarkable seismic change in the way that essentially these companies that are instruments of our destruction in a lot of ways will not be able to access our capital anymore. So I think simply the concept of reciprocity, which is something that the Trump administration has harped on in many contexts with respect to the Chinese Communist Party, reciprocity alone in the treatment of Chinese businesses would make a massive difference in this regard. But I think when it comes to the corporate world trying to impose left-wing views on Americans, unfortunately, the big problem that we have is we have a culture that's dominated in all of these critical influential institutions by leftism. So there needs to be a counter to it. That really starts, frankly, down to the grade school level, sadly, because that's where this leftist indoctrination really begins. And it simply filters up through institutions of higher education, through our pop culture, and sadly now through our business world as well.
The march through the institutions, as the cultural Marxists have long called it, is reaching this new zenith, I guess. And we have to be alive to it. And I would also add that one of the other things that we could do is prevent men and women in uniform and their federal civilian government employee counterparts from having their retirement funds invested in the kinds of companies that you've been talking about in China. This is a topic we'll return to with Kevin Freeman in a few minutes. Thank you, Ben Weingarten, for your support for all of these principles and for your extraordinarily effective advocacy of them at the Federalist and elsewhere. I know you'll keep it up. Come back to us again soon. Next up, we'll speak with Claudia Rosette about the World Health Organization and China's exploitation of the pandemic they unleashed on the world. That and much more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We are visiting in this segment with a dear friend and one of the country's foremost investigative reporters. Her name is Claudia Rosette. Her beat is, well, the world's trouble spots, and a lot of that beat at the moment focuses on communist China, a country she knows well, having lived in Hong Kong for a number of years, having reported and editorialized for the Wall Street Journal from that post, among others. These days, she is blogging at PJ Media and writing periodically in other outlets, including the Dallas Morning News. We're always delighted to catch up with her, especially at a moment like this when clear-eyed thinking about what China is up to is absolutely vital. Claudia Rosette, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. Great to have you. You've written, before we turn full on to China, I wanted to just touch base with you about something. You've developed over the years a special expertise with respect to international organizations. And there's been a lot of talk, particularly since President Trump decided to suspend funding for the World Health Organization while he had an investigation done into its conduct. Specifically, it's, well, slavish following the Chinese Communist Party line about the coronavirus 19. You've argued that the place needs to be investigated, and this is the perfect time to do it, and that the president is quite justified in withholding funding during that period. Walk us through that quickly, if you would, Claudia.
Yeah, China has devoted a lot of time and effort to studying any way to exploit the international system. You know, the great hope with Nixon's opening to China and the decades of engagement since was that it would sort of bring China toward political reform. Instead, China's Communist Party has exploited everything it has come across to adapt in order to actually at this stage tighten its control at home and have this rise of importance on the world stage, which we're currently living out in the form of the coronavirus pandemic, but worse looms beyond that with its modern military and so on. And one of the arenas that China has put special attention into is the United Nations, the multilateral sort of leading international system that's supposed to maintain peace, promote progress, and so on. And they have, on a number of fronts, sort of colonized, if you like, the UN. That used to be the stomping ground of the Soviet Union. When that collapsed, there was a period where it was sort of up for grabs. And China, more and more, has moved in. And with the WHO, they actually, their candidate ran it from 2007 for two terms, 10 years, Margaret Chan. She was from Hong Kong. Okay, which is, that's complicated in the sense that the people of Hong Kong, 7.5 million people, the great, you know, millions of them have been demanding the democracy that they were promised under terms of the handover from the British, are people who want democratic rule and have been using their dwindling free speech to say so. But the government in Hong Kong is basically rigged, appointed by or rigged to favor Beijing. And Margaret Chan was part of that. In fact, she came under heavy criticism in Hong Kong for mishandling SARS when that broke out in late 2002-2003. So China nominated her as to head the World Health Organization. She got the job. That was part of the effort to engage China and, you know, be nice to China and so on. And also China at that stage had become very good at buying up considerable influence inside the UN. And one of the ways that is done is China does a lot of business and can easily work into terms of business deals outside the UN, things that affect voting patterns inside.
They buy people, in other words, at the United Nations.
That would be a way of looking, yes, that would be a way of describing it. Precisely. The payoffs are rich if you come their way, and the punishment can be harsh if you don't. I mean, as even the National Basketball Association found out last year, right? So China has had a heavy influence there for quite some time. Then we get the arrival of another candidate, a new election for director general. China backs Dr. Tedros, who is now the director general of the WHO. And we do not know precisely what arrangements were made. We don't. Okay, so let's give him the benefit of the doubt and simply say his views happen to align so immaculately with China's that it's really hard to tell the difference, that in many of the statements and actions that Tedros has taken, since he's not actually a medical doctor, he has a degree in, I think it's philosophy of community medicine from a university in England. In almost all the actions he's taken and things he's said in dealing with this pandemic, He could have been it's working for China's propaganda ministry, from his praise for the transparency and, you know, he just lavished praise on China for its handling of the pandemic. What's become increasingly clear, but was clear even when he was doing this back in January, is that China waited long enough to basically ensure that this disease would spread throughout the world. They did not try to contain it. They knew for weeks that it was contagious. They simply didn't try to contain it. They did the opposite.
Facilitated its spread. And Tedros was essentially parroting their line with respect to the disease and how to manage it and what need not be done and what should be done and on and on. It wasn't just the sort of propaganda. It was operationalizing that propaganda as well. No?
Correct. He was holding up China as the example to the world. Hey, if you just follow the totalitarian model, you too can have disease control when you finally lock down everything. He also flew to, it was the WHO that kept recommending that international travel carry on even after China had locked down Wuhan. Again, that's the famous contention over the travel ban. President Trump restricted travel from China. It was the WHO that provided sort of China's flag to wave, saying it's WHO policy that you should keep travel open.
So, Claudia, there's a lot here that's objectionable, clearly, but this is a moment, you argue, for investigating the WHO and to withhold funding from it. I think this is a no-brainer myself, but just in the shortest of short forms, why do you think those who argue that the pandemic is no time to be doing this are wrong?
Oh, because when you're getting the wrong directions, you don't want to keep going. You know, the WHO has steered us in the wrong direction over and over. One of the really signal moments was the January 14th tweet that there is no clear evidence of person-to-person transmission, where the WHO just relayed what China wanted them to say.
And there's evidence that this is continuing. So, Claudia, before we run out of time with you, I wanted to touch on one other thing that you've been writing about at the Dallas Morning News most recently, and that is other ways in which China is exploiting the pandemic that it unleashed on the world to advance its agenda. And we won't do justice to this, but just give us sort of the distilled essence of your thinking on how they're doing that and its implications.
Yeah, well, first up is the horrible bullying and crushing of rights that's been going on right under in China's shadow in Hong Kong. The crackdown on leading democracy advocates, including Martin Lee, who has not been charged before. He's been arrested twice, but never actually charged. And now China is really making its move. At the moment, Hong Kong has coronavirus quarantine that does not allow non-residents, foreigners to fly in. So all this is taking place sort of in the China murk, and they are just ripping away the rights that they promised under treaty with the British for 50 years to Hong Kong. So gross violation of that treaty, threats to Taiwan, you know, bomber buzzings into, at one stage, into airspace where they are not supposed to go. And I'm profoundly concerned about Taiwan. I think that China doesn't like it at all that Taiwan had a very successful model of disease control from the beginning, saw the danger, you know, acted on it, and stands in sharp contrast, if you just look, to China's totalitarian methods, where they were locking people into their homes to die, dragging families forcibly out, disappeared journalists. Taiwan actually held a democratic presidential election in early January. Okay, the threats to Taiwan, the further turf grabs of islands where China should not be at all in the South China Sea, where they're continuing to enhance the facilities. That's a threat to shipping.
Declaring these as administrative zones that are internal to China's nation, as I understand it, among other things.
Correct. The incredible propaganda that's been going on to say to the world, where China's trying to put out to the world the line, they know how to handle this. They're on top of this. Look at America, the limp Western democracies, as China. They've been sending, although I think in many cases people have been paying for it, so they've been profiting as well, protective medical gear, which has turned out to be defective, having bought it up in bulk in January when they knew that this was in the works. And now parcel, also they received huge donations of aid from a sympathetic free world, and now have turned around to say, basically, China has been gloating, strutting, parading itself, saying, look at us, we're the great model, stick with us, we can handle this. China caused this.
As I'm fond of saying, Claudia, they claim in not quite as many words, communism is a cure for coronavirus, and emulate our model, all will be well. We'll tell you what to do, we'll tell you how to do it, we'll give you the technology to enforce our form of, as you say, totalitarian control. Claudia, we are hard out of time. Alas, there's much, much more to talk with you about. I hope you'll come back to us again very soon. It's great visiting, and thank you for your insights on WHO and the Chinese Communist Party and so much more. I know you'll keep it up at PJ Media and also at the Independent Women's Forum, and we look forward to talking with you soon. Next up, we'll speak with Grant Newsham. We'll get a military man's view on what China is doing to exploit the coronavirus, that and much more, straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. We are joined, I'm pleased to say, by Colonel Grant Newsham, United States Marine Corps retired, a man who has worked for our country in a number of capacities, not only in the uniform of the United States Marine Corps, but also as a diplomat. He has served in international business executive roles as well in Japan, where we are catching up with him. Today, he's a senior research fellow at the Japan Forum for Strategic Studies and a very prolific contributor to the public policy debate in a number of outlets, including Asia Times. Grant, it's very good to have you with us, and I appreciate you taking a few minutes to talk about some of your recent writings in Asia Times and your current thinking on specifically the topic we just visited about with Claudia Rosette, namely China and its exploitation of the coronavirus it unleashed on the world. Welcome back. So you have particularly been raising a warning about the possibility that China may seek to take advantage of our distractedness or the fact that our carriers in the Western Pacific are down at the moment due to the coronavirus. Give us your flavor, if you would, Grant, on the sort of state of the U.S.-China military balance in the Pacific and whether this may be subject to some exploitation as well by the Chinese in the near future.
I think the balance was actually not very good even before the coronavirus, the CCP virus hit. The Chinese conventional military balance in the Western, particularly in the East China Sea, South China Sea, the West Pacific, the extreme West Pacific closer to China, was not very good. It was really, I think, China has the advantage. One's almost embarrassed to say that, but in terms of the number of ships and aircraft, the long-range missiles that they could bring to bear, they can make life very difficult for U.S. naval forces in particular in that area. And that was something that certainly needs corrected quickly. And I think China saw the trend actually moving in its favor. And now that the virus has hit, and it's, to put it mildly, it's a distraction, to say the least, for the United States in every respect. China has flexed its muscles in the South China Sea and the East China Sea as well.
Grant Newsham, I was struck by something you said in a recent piece on this subject at Asia Times, where you suggested that the United States arguably still enjoys a qualitative edge over the Chinese. I'm reminded of Stalin's famous quip that quantity has a quality all its own. But as a student of these things, how, quite apart from the quantitative edge that the Chinese have now been engineering, notably with this enormous buildup in ships and aircraft and missiles that you mentioned, do we in fact still have, on a one-to-one basis, a qualitative edge, would you say?
It depends on what you're talking about, and more particularly where you're talking about and when. Yes, and overall, we probably have a qualitative advantage, but that's really an academic question. When you're talking about the South China Sea and the East China Sea region, because you have to consider what China can put together at a particular time in a particular place to match whatever forces we have. And they can sort of outnumber us if they do it right in terms of ships and aircraft by 5-1, 10-1. It's astonishing. Plus the one very simple sort of data point is that Chinese anti-ship missiles outrange ours by about 50 miles at least. So you can't even get in for a shot before they've gotten off quite a few. So you do have to be careful of the actual correlation of forces in a particular location. But it does not, the Chinese can stack it up pretty well in their favor. We are giving our submarines as a lot of credit, and they are an ace of the hole, but they only take you so far.
Yeah, and they are beavering away at anti-submarine capabilities that may make that a much more difficult ace card to play. There was also a report this week, Grant, that came to my attention yesterday from Dr. Peter Vincent Pry, that the United States has withdrawn its B-52 bombers that have been stationed for a number of years in Guam. I gather there are four B-1 bombers that have been flown in temporarily there. But Peter was very concerned for what this probably signaled to the Chinese, as well as to our allies in the region, namely that the United States has now been scared out of Guam because it can be easily targeted by not only Chinese missiles, but their proxies in North Korea now as well. Your thoughts on the strategic implications of that step and the signals that might be sent this regard?
I would say the short-term optics don't look good because it does look as if the Americans have pulled back at the time they're talking about increasing and making their commitment to the region more serious. So when you have the Air Force pull its B-52s back, it obviously raises eyebrows. And if you have to explain it, explain why it doesn't really mean what it looks like, that you put yourself at a disadvantage. But what matters now is what the Air Force does. If they start a continuous, aggressive campaign of rotating bombers, and in particular through the region at different bases for different lengths of time, you can actually end up with a better deterrent and actual operational capacity than you had with bombers in Guam permanently, and a very easy target for the Chinese. So let's look at what the Air Force now does. If the rotations step up and you see them all over the place for different lengths of time, that would actually be, maybe an improvement in some respects. But say the timing of the withdrawal from Guam is really what was troubling. But let's see what they do now.
This raises the question that you and I have talked about periodically, and that is the presence, temporary, ephemeral, though it may be, its value in signaling to the Chinese that we are capable of projecting power decisively if we choose to do so, on the one hand, and on the other hand, the permanent presence that they have been establishing, notably on these fortified bastions in the South China Sea, and that they are now seemingly trying to institutionalize even further by declaring administrative zones that now extend China's control very clearly over these waters and air in the international spaces. Talk about this as an asymmetric challenge for us.
Yes, well, what you just described is the Chinese, say, declaring a specific type of administrative control over some of their unlawfully held islands in the South China Sea. But this is one manifestation of the Chinese just tightening their grip over the area. And you go down the list just in the last couple of months since the virus hit, and they've sunk a Vietnamese fishing boat. They locked on to a Philippine Navy ship ready to shoot. They've been doing much more provocative things towards Taiwan more regularly, and the nature of it's different as well. They've just nonstop on just the venomous propaganda that you see. And most recently, down in the southern part of the South China Sea, like 900 miles from China, you've had the Chinese maritime militia accompanying a Chinese survey ship with Chinese Coast Guard there and with the Chinese Navy in the background to harass and intimidate a Malaysian survey ship that is surveying in Malaysia's exclusive economic zone. And there's also, that didn't get much attention, but off of Shanghai a couple of months ago, or almost, a Japanese Navy ship was collided with a Chinese fishing ship. And not much has been said about this. But apparently, from what the reports, that the Chinese Navy ship had a gash in the left, in the port side, which suggests it was rammed. And so add that to the list. But the Malaysian example is a very good one because it highlights a couple things. In particular, really the lengths that China is going to sort of assert its authority, but also the Americans showed up in the middle of this with the USS America, an amphibious assault ship. Two frigates and an Australian frigate showed up as well. And the Americans were there with the Australians for a few days, you know, in the mix and sort of showing that, you know, America wasn't, you know, was there to protect its interests and protect its friends. And then the Americans went home. The Malaysian, you know, we look at it as having sent a message, and the Malaysians are saying, well, look, you came and you left. You left us to deal with the Chinese by ourselves. Thank you very much. Now, of course, the Malaysians, they could offer to host our forces in Malaysia if they wanted to. But nonetheless, you know, we have trouble with our staying power, and that needs addressed.
Indeed. This adds to a point that you made in your piece in the Asia Times the other day, which is that those three U.S. ships with their Australian complement might have felt pretty lonely out there in that South China Sea. We've also had the Chinese propaganda arms boasting that they've driven a U.S. destroyer out of the Taiwan Strait, as I recall. So all of this seems to bespeak a ratcheting up and an ambition on the part of the Chinese that may only be sated by an actual act of aggression against us. I fear that unless we are alive to that possibility, that's a distinct, well, prospect at the moment. Grant Newsom, I appreciate you walking through all of this with us, and I know you're monitoring it closely from your perch in Japan at the Japan Forum for Strategic Studies, and we look forward to your further visits with us about all of this. And thank you as well for your participation in the Committee on the Present Danger, China, which is benefiting greatly from your insights as well. Take good care, my friend, and stay safe. Next up, we'll speak with Kevin Freeman about the Thrift Savings Plan and the economic war on the American energy sector and more straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back for one of the high points of our week here at Secure Freedom Radio, and that is our weekly visit inside the war room. The Economic War Room, whose master is Kevin Freeman. Economic War Room with Kevin Freeman, of course, is a very important product of Blaze TV, and you can find out how you can receive it and often get clips and battle plans of Economic War Room at economicwarroom.com. Kevin is, of course, also the author of two terrific books, Secret Weapon and Game Plan, and he blogs as well at globaleconomicwarfare.com. Kevin Freeman, it's good to have you back. Welcome. I have a couple of things on my mind, and I need to move through these smartly. So let me ask you very briefly. We spoke earlier in the program with Ben Weingarten about this thrift savings plan business, and I'm interested in your assessment. We are told the president does not want our military men and women and their civilian government employee counterparts in the federal government to be obliged to invest their money in Chinese companies, including some particularly malevolent ones. What's your understanding of the state of play at the moment, and what should be done in that regard?
Well, I mean, please, it's come to the president's attention. I mean, beyond the president not wanting it, the actual servicemen and women, the investors don't want it. They don't want their money to be automatically placed into Chinese investments that may be malevolent to our country. I mean, the idea that they want to invest globally, that's fine. They want to invest in other countries, and there's an option to do that. But the option requires a certain amount of money, and it could be billions, tens of billions of dollars going into the very companies that threaten our security, maybe threaten the people of China, are surveilling and watching people. So, yes, President Trump has, I knew he would the moment it was brought to his attention. He said, this is obvious. It should be obvious to everyone. Only Wall Street, which has been corrupted by the dollars that China has flowed to them, only Wall Street thinks it's a good idea. Everybody else says that's ridiculous. And so President Trump is lined up with our servicemen and women and our patriotic employees and federal government employees.
So now it remains to be seen what implementation will be done. This administration, unfortunately, as we've been talking about in connection with the electric grid, executive orders, and other things, has had the president's intention not always faithfully executed by the deep state, shall we say. What is your understanding, Kevin Freeman, of the current state of play with respect to implementing this presidential direction to prevent something that hasn't happened just yet, but it's imminent, unfortunately, this kind of investment of our federal retirement savings funds into Chinese companies, including problematic ones?
Well, you know, this has been a long-term chess game, and Frank, you've been leading the charge here. Those that are deep staters, that are globalists, that don't necessarily have the best interests of America at heart, have gone down the path of putting our money in China. And we've, at every point, with intelligent people like Roger Robinson and Kyle Bass and others, tried to block that. And at every point, they've come up with a workaround. I have no doubt that they are right now trying to water down the president's intentions. Fortunately, this is a very strong president. And as long as he rides herd on it, as long as he realizes that they're doing that to him, and we have good people with good means of stopping that, if we write a solid executive order that he signs and puts out there, this will be a huge victory for the American people. But there will be every attempt on the progressive left, on the globalist side, on the deep state side, to derail that intention, and we must not let that happen. This is something the American people need to rise up. That's why we made that program that is available at economicwarroom.com. You can see it on our program on the Thrift Savings Plan, and you can see Alan West leading the charge with Kyle Bass and Roger Robinson and veterans who've got, you know, one individual, Alan Clark, dear friend, he gave two legs in the fight in Vietnam, and he says, I don't want my money funding communist China.
No, it was a very powerful video, Kevin, and again, just one of the examples of how materially you're contributing through Economic War Room with Kevin Freeman to these public policy debates. And one point that I particularly wanted just to draw you out on, Kevin Freeman, is the extent to which China has amazingly been able to get access to these funds in our capital markets, be listed these companies on our capital markets without conforming to the same accounting and other standards that American companies, and for that matter, other foreign companies have to meet. How is that? And what needs to be done to remedy it?
Well, China's been very good at infiltrating institutions. They're very good at that, whether it's the World Health Organization or the United Nations, or in this case, their influence on the Securities Exchange Commission. They've somehow conned our SEC into believing that it's okay for them not to conform to our accounting standards because their accounting is a state secret, and therefore we don't need to know what it is. Well, that's ludicrous. We've seen over and over and over examples of Chinese accounting fraud where they don't even have real companies, but they bring investors in and they show a factory one day claiming it's one company and the next day claiming it's another, raising money. This is something that's got to be stopped. All companies listed on American stock exchanges should have to conform to U.S. accounting standards. It only levels the playing field. Otherwise, American companies are automatically disadvantaged to the Chinese company. Even if they're honest, they're disadvantaged. and they're not always honest.
They're certainly not always honest, and that goes without saying about the Chinese Communist Party itself. Kevin, let me turn to another topic that I know you've been thinking hard about. Indeed, you've done a program with Troy Andrews about it just recently, namely the war on the U.S. energy sector, an economic war on our country, indeed. Tell us a little bit about the video you've just done, how people can get access to it, and the main takeaways.
Yeah, so energy is a part of almost every economic war. It has been since oil first gushed out of the ground in Pennsylvania and also in Oklahoma. Oil has been a critical issue. And a few weeks ago, oil actually, for the first time in history, went negative, meaning that if you drilled and produced a barrel of oil out of the ground, you had to pay someone to haul it off. Rather than them paying you as much as $150 a barrel, which is what the price was 12 years ago. And that's because there is a massive amount of new supply from the shale industry. There is a dearth of usage demand because of the COVID-19. And there is also this component where Russia and Saudi Arabia were literally adding extra oil to the mix with the hope that prices would go down to bankrupt our shale industry. Nobody wants to admit it, but that's basically what happened, and it's not the first time. It's happened a couple of times. And so we had Troy in, and we talked about what that means. The world 5 years from now is going to be demanding more oil than they did last year. There will be huge demand, but the problem is there's no storage on the planet. Where do you put the extra oil? And so we walk through all of those dynamics, which makes for energy wars, and we're seeing that happen, and it's opened opportunities and risks for investors.
It has indeed. I commend to everyone economicwarroom.com as a means of finding the kind of information Kevin has just very briefly touched on, and we'll look forward, Kevin, to hearing more about it. Just to close up, when you look at this negative cost of energy, how on earth does the industry survive, our fracking industry specifically, until such time as the economy is opened up and demand increases or production storage is expanded dramatically?
Well, some of the industry has already hedged against that. And so they've sold oil in the future at higher prices. Others are going to have to go through bankruptcy. Others will have to do restructuring. The critical thing is we have to keep the equipment and the asset in the ground so that we can use it should Saudi Arabia or Russia ever in the future attempt to drive prices higher and crater our economy. We can put more storage in the U.S. energy reserve. We've got to do whatever we can to preserve this critical national security asset.
Namely, the ability to frack and do the lateral tapping of oil fields that has become translated into the United States becoming a net exporter of these energy supplies. Once the world is back in business, that's obviously going to be needed, but it is urgently the case that we have to preserve that capability today. I couldn't agree with you more about that, Kevin Freeman. I appreciate your time today, Kevin, as always, and the great work that you're doing at Blaze TV and elsewhere. I also want to commend to our listeners, in connection with what we talked about concerning the investments in China of pension funds and other resources, the work that Kevin Freeman is leading on patriotic investing at the National Security Investment Consultants Institute. Kevin, thanks for all of that and for joining us today. We'll talk with you again next week. We'll talk with the rest of you again, I hope, tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.